pussy sweeter than McCready when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll continue reading from Wish You Were Here, a collection of essays from the editor of Our State magazine, by Elizabeth Hudson. Game of Life. My grandfather, Charles Harris Hudson, was a golfer. He wore a baby blue bucket hat with tees stuck in the brim and walked around the house with a golf ball in his pocket, turning it over in his hands like a worry stone. Like many golfers who don't have the luxury of their own caddy, he often came home with lots of things tucked in his pockets. His leather golf glove, extra tees, folded score sheets, stubby pencils. In the winter, he'd stand over the heating grate in the hallway of the house and practice his putting stroke, patting his feet back and forth, working his stance just right. By the 1st of March, he'd head for the golf course early in the morning, before the leagues arrived, stepping out onto fresh greens as untrammeled as new-fallen snow. He loved the game and, evidently, was good at it. I know he shot his age numerous times and won a couple of city tournaments, but I never knew what drew him to it. By the time I came along, my grandfather had been a lot of things in his life, but none of them had anything to do with golf. He started out as a baseball player. In the 1930s, he played third base for an Industrial League team, and he got an invitation, the dream of his life, to try out for the St. Louis Cardinals. He went to Missouri, but got spiked in the knee during the first round of tryouts. It ended any hope he had of playing professional ball, and he came home, disappointed but true to his character, not dejected. He switched his interest to tennis. He earned the nickname Ace by winning a Greensboro championship match. Meanwhile, during the war years, he was drafted into the civil service and became a welder. The government sent him to a shipyard in Virginia, where he helped build an aircraft carrier, the USS Midway, while my grandmother stayed home in North Carolina with her three children. He didn't play anything during that time. When he finished his service, he returned home, where his family now was living in Coleridge, and he began to make his living as a salesman. He sold Blue Cross Blue Shield insurance, and he loved the work so much he continued making sales calls well into his retirement. I remember when he'd put on a suit and lay his briefcase, stuffed with Blue Cross pamphlets, across the front seat of his Oldsmobile. On those days, he'd leave the house to call on a customer, full of the anticipation of a sell, a win. In 1982, my grandfather found out he had colon cancer. The doctors put him in the hospital. He had surgery, an awful kind, and then they sent him home. They gave him 6 months to live. One morning, remarkably, he awoke with a sudden burst of energy. He got out of bed, dressed, and scrawled a note in pencil across the top of one of his insurance envelopes. "Don't worry about me," it read. "I'll be all right." My grandfather stuck this note in between the salt and pepper shakers on the kitchen table and, without telling a soul, snuck out of the house and went to the golf course. I've since learned that this spontaneous burst of energy with a terminal illness is common, and also short-lived. But on that day, he felt good. He put a few golf balls in his pocket, climbed behind the wheel of his Olds, and drove to the golf course, his own place of peace, where he played and played until it was time, finally, to come home. In Memory of Woods and Water. When I was 9 years old, my parents bought the first and only house they've ever owned, and we moved from our small rental in downtown Asheboro to the southwestern part of the county. Out here, our house backed up to acres of dense woods, and a long dirt road sliced the edge of our backyard, snaking up a long hill toward the few other houses that were sequestered in the rural landscape. On the day we moved, I walked the length of that dirt road, about a mile from top to bottom, in hopes that someone my age lived nearby. It was a solitary walk, and before I gave up and went home, I gouged out a message in the dirt road with a stick. "Hi," I scraped in the dirt. "I am looking for a friend." I scrawled my name, Elizabeth, and drew an arrow to my house. In retrospect, it was a silly thing to do. Of course, I didn't foresee the fleeting nature of riding in dirt. One slight gust of wind, or a pickup truck barreling down the road, would have wiped clean my hopeful call for friendship. But evidently, that didn't happen. For some reason, my message stayed, and the next day, Krista Payne, a neighbor who had been riding her bicycle down the road, knocked on our back door. Krista was about my age, one grade below me, and she lived with her younger brother and parents in the house nearest ours, on the other side of the dirt road. She had seen my message and had come to the house to meet me. Krista and I became instant friends, and we spent long hours together, swinging on her porch and throwing a ball with her brother and retreating to our deep woods, where our imaginations took root. Here we pretended that the towering pine trees were walls of our house, the rotting stumps were our chairs. We rode on fallen log horses and fought mystical branch creatures. On foot we chased each other through tangled weeds, edging deeper in, eventually stumbling down the slope of a hill to come upon an ankle-deep, clear-water creek. Krista and I were drawn to the water. We spent early Saturday mornings at the creek, plunging our hands in up to our wrists, pretending to pan for imaginary gold like we'd learned to do at Reed's gold mine. After a rain, we'd watch for tiny toads, and on the hottest days, we pushed up our pants legs to wade in the water, holding on to each other's shoulders, our breath catching with those first cold steps. We laughed a lot. Then we got older. Instead of wading in the water, we'd sit on granite boulders that had somehow worked their way out of the earth. Our conversations changed from make-believe houses to less childish topics, boys and school and hopes and fears. We tossed pebbles into the water and stared at the lazy ripples in the slow-moving current. We watched as the detritus of nature drifted toward some other place, toward a larger stream, maybe, eventually moving toward some ancient, nameless river. We never knew where the water came from, and now I wish we'd looked. I wish we'd walked along the water's edge, searching for where it came from, and following it where it led. Eventually, of course, Krista and I drifted. We grew up. We moved away. The dirt road that ran between our houses has long since been paved, and the woods have mostly been cleared, infiltrated with other development. As I write this, the foundation for another house sits in the middle of it all. It's hard for me to look at. I cope with the changes by hoping that whoever moves here, when this new house is finally completed, has a child who is eager to explore the rooms of these woods, someone who will catch a glimpse of the creek's shimmer through the brush, and chase it to its source, running alongside as its current and all the things it carries rushes by. A season of promise. On the street where I live, a massive white oak anchors the edge of my neighbor's yard. The tree is at least 100 years old, or it was anyway, until it finally fell recently, the victim of weakness or disease or maybe just old age. On the day it fell, we all heard it hit. It struck the earth like cannon fire, carrying it with it a lifetime of history. Battle scars from ferocious summertime thunderstorms and winter icing, remnants of birds' nests built in its upper limbs, specters of long-ago children playing beneath it, tagging it as home base in front yard ballgames, and swinging from its branches. On the day it fell, we, the whole neighborhood, came rushing out of our homes to see what had happened, and to stare at this giant, whose upturned roots spilled out from its underside, like entrails. We stood around its wide canopy that had shielded our street from the hottest days of summer, disbelieving that this icon, this symbol of our neighborhood, was no more. On the day that it fell, we felt this loss. The tree lay lifeless across the neighbor's yard and into the street, and nobody knew what to do. We edged close to it, tentatively, as if this behemoth might somehow, suddenly, lift its limp branches to rise up and right itself. On the day it fell, we were struck with the realization that, in nature, nothing stays the same. This tree was one of the reasons I love living where I live. It reminded me of what this area of Guilford County must have looked like a century ago, before development cut deep, before my 1970s-era cul-de-sac was carved out of what was once, before anyone arrived, a dense oak forest. I'm reminded of this former landscape when I take my morning walk through the neighborhood in the springtime. Our acidic soil, enhanced by so many acorns, deepens the blue in the clusters of hydrangeas that I see from house to house, and encourages a delirious production of azaleas. I've often believed the azaleas in Greensboro are the most vibrant anywhere, and I think it's because of that oaky soil. White oaks like the one that fell in my neighborhood have a significant place in Greensboro's history. One of the Cone Mills textile plants was named the White Oak Plant because of the 200-year-old tree that stood on the property. That manufacturing plant became one of the largest indigo dyeing operations in the world. It needed 10 warehouses just for its inventory, and even had its own power plant. Even now, there is so much that has survived with the White Oak name. Entire neighborhoods, city streets, plenty of churches, even a lake. Today I walked the neighborhood for the first time after a long, cold winter. It was 60 degrees and sunny, a midwinter tease of spring. I walked past the house, no longer in the shadow of the white oak. It's strange to see this altered landscape, but I'm getting used to it. For years, the view from the street was a towering tree. But now, instead of seeing the thick swath of green leaves overhead, I see brilliant blue sky, opening up to a realm of possibilities. It's just as beautiful. The Saltwater Cure. When I was 9 years old, jumping around in the old woodshed behind my grandmother's house, I took a splinter, 2 inches long, right in the toe. I ran inside in tears, hopping and holding my foot so she could see the jagged shard deep beneath the skin. It wasn't my first splinter, or my last, but this was different. It needed something more than tweezers. My grandmother ran warm water in a wash bucket and poured in about a quarter of a box of salt from the Morton's container. She told me to sit there, on the edge of the kitchen chair, with my foot immersed in the bucket, for about half an hour. I was fidgety, focused on the pain in my toe. "Be still," she said, "and let the water do its work." Before long, the water had not only numbed my sore toe, but also the splinter had worked its way out. The next time I looked down into the salty water, it was drifting to the bottom of the bucket. It was my first lesson in learning about salt water's capacity to mend. I've used this trick ever since to remove splinters, soothe a sore throat, wash out a cut. I have no idea whether this treatment is medically sound, but it seems to make things better, and that's good enough for me. A few years ago, I was reminded of the restorative power of salt water during a trip to the beach. After what had been a long and weary drive from Greensboro, I landed at the Yacht Basin Provision Company, a seafood shack in Southport. Here, the salty sea air had taken its toll, seasoning the wooden structure and adding a patina of rust to the propane tanks that sit outside the door. Inside, I ordered a yellowfin tuna sandwich off the chalkboard menu and walked out to the open-air deck overlooking the waterway to eat it. Strains of Willie Nelson singing "Sitting on Top of the World" played over the sound system. Pelicans dipped in and out of the water from the dock, and boats skimmed nearby, a reminder of the omnipresent fishermen who, on their daily journey of ocean and sky, make their life from this salty sea. I sat here for a couple of hours and thought about what it means to be connected to the water, to the ocean. I thought about its immense history, about its power to restore, to heal, to mend. About how, as Carl Sandburg said, it must know more than any of us. More than anything, I think, it knows how to calm and soothe our souls. When we are still, and let it do its work. Freedom on Two Wheels. My first bike was a cobalt blue Schwinn Fairlady, the girl's version of the classic Stingray. It had plastic streamers that flapped from its high-rise handlebars and a wide white banana seat, and I loved it. I rode as fast as the training wheels would let me, mostly around the gravel parking lot that was behind my mom's needlework shop on Fayetteville Street in Ashboro. One day in June, my dad told me we were going to take off the training wheels. It was time, he said, for me to learn how to ride on my own. I watched as he laid the bike down on its side and worked the wheels off with a wrench. He righted the bike, patted the seat, and told me to hop on. I was unsure of this, scared that I wouldn't be able to balance, scared I would fall. Dad held on to the bike while I swung my leg over and put my feet on top of the studded pedals. I wobbled. My dad gripped the back of the bike, keeping it upright so I wouldn't topple over. Then he started running behind me, holding me steady and pushing me forward at the same time. He was saying, "Now pedal, pedal." And I did. I pumped my legs and the front wheel started to weave erratically. Then somehow the bike straightened up. Now I was pushing the pedals with my feet, and I was moving, not wobbling. The moment I felt like I had control of the bike, I turned around, expecting to see my dad right there with his hand on the back. But he was far away, standing in the middle of the gravel lot, watching me go. I remember feeling a sense of surprise that I was on my own. I was actually riding a bike by myself. And then I saw him grinning, laughing, raising his hands over his head, and waving wildly at me. He was yelling, "Hold on! Hold on!" And I did. I remember what it felt like. It was independence, newfound freedom, and fright. The security and safety those extra wheels provided were gone. The security and safety my dad provided were, too. But in that moment, when I looked over my shoulder, I also saw his excitement and pride. I look back now and I think, how did he do it? How did he bring himself to release his hold on me, his only child, there in that gravel driveway? Knowing that I could very well fall, knowing that I could very well fail. How do fathers manage to let go? How do they stand back when their children, their only sons, their only daughters, drive a car or go on a date for the first time? How do they watch their children pack up and go off to college for the first time, where they could very well fall, where they could very well fail? How do they let go and move out of the way when the boxes get packed? When the children move away, get married, ride off into the distance. And yet, somehow they do. One day in June, my dad let go of the back of the bike, and he taught me to ride all by myself. He held me steady and pushed me forward at the same time. Maybe it takes the same kind of courage to let go as it does to hold on. The Best Sandwich. A few months ago, I had lunch with my mom in the break room at her work. It was her 60th birthday, and I'd offered to take her out, anywhere she wanted. She told me that she'd rather eat the sandwich she'd brought from home. Initially, I wasn't sure why she didn't want to go out. We should do something special on her birthday, I thought. But so she wouldn't have to eat alone, I packed a lunch for myself and joined her. As I unwrapped my peanut butter and jelly, simple, nothing fancy, my mom pulled her lunch from a paper sack, ham and cheese. To anyone else, it was ordinary. But as soon as I saw it, I remembered something about my parents that I'd forgotten. Every day, my dad packs my mom's lunch for her. He's been doing this for years, ever since he retired. There's a method to his sandwich construction, and I could see how carefully he went about it. 5 thin slices of meat, I know he would have counted the slices, layered with cheese, and stacked between 2 pieces of soft bread, each one spread with a deliberate amount of mayonnaise. He had also included a handful of potato chips, folded neatly in saran wrap, 2 oatmeal cookies, and a little Tupperware tumbler of sweet tea. We ate quietly, contentedly. I could see how happy she was, how much it meant to know that someone thought enough to put together a lunch bag for her. "It's good," my mom said, nodding between bites. And I knew it was. To anyone else, my mom's meal would have been forgettable. But as I watched her eat and saw her enjoyment, I realized what went into the making of this lunch. 30 years ago, my dad opened a small sandwich shop, a place called Phil's, in downtown Asheboro. He had the menu standards, foot-long hot dogs and hamburgers. But what made the place special was his homemade sandwich food fare. Grilled pimento cheese, chicken salad, egg salad. These were his own recipes, each one spiked with a special ingredient to add flavor, like extra sweet pickle juice drizzled into the tuna fish. My dad worked hard to prepare such unassuming food. I remember the long nights he spent hunched over our dining room table at home, hand-chopping pounds of chicken into small pieces and grating blocks of cheddar cheese by hand. My dad's sandwich shop was a good place, a welcoming place, a place people could get a good lunch for a fair price. Simple, nothing fancy. Back then, we all ate where the food was familiar, where we all knew what we were going to get. We ate at the Blue Mist and the Little Dipper and Hop's Barbecue. We ate at Little Castle on Sunset Avenue. Even now, I can taste those cheeseburgers at Little Castle. Juicy meat, a flat-top bun, the old-timey kind, glistening with grease from the grill. When I was in high school, Amy McBride and I started every Friday night the same way. We settled into a booth inside Sir Pizza and ordered our favorite, a medium ham and pepperoni pizza and 2 Diet Cokes. It's what we liked. It's what we knew. There's comfort in the familiar. A sandwich sliced the right way. A warm pickle pressed on top of bread, softening a circle beneath it. The crumple of parchment paper around a cheeseburger. The recognizable whoosh of a bun steamer. We know what's coming next, and we look forward to it. Something simple, nothing fancy. 2 months ago, I went home to visit my dad for his 73rd birthday. When I walked into the house, he was already pulling a container of egg salad from the refrigerator. He makes a great sandwich. I know many of his secrets, yet I can't figure out what he does to food that makes it taste so good. It's something I can't seem to replicate in my own home. Somehow, I suspect it doesn't have anything to do with the food itself. I think my mom knows that, too. "Can I make you some lunch?" he asked me. I couldn't think of any meal I'd enjoy more.
Because I'm always alone, I'm just a Carolina rolling. I'm just a Carolina rolling stone.
Brewing sunshine in a gallon jar. Many years ago, while my parents were working long hours running their shop, I spent my summer days at my grandmother's house. We read books and went for a walk every day, stopping at neighbors' houses for something to drink and to admire their flower gardens. We fried okra and clipped laundry to the clothesline, and in late afternoons we sat in the porch swing, kicking our feet just enough to keep it swaying, to keep the breeze going. By August, summer moved in slow motion, and when the sun finally shot the temperatures into the 90s, the heat whipped us. We stopped using the stove to cook. We stayed inside, confined to the one room in the house that had a box unit air conditioner mounted in the window. We stuck our faces up to it and breathed in the shock of cold air. We froze bananas and ate them like popsicles to stay cool. And we soaked towels in ammonia spirits and draped them across our necks. One afternoon, while flipping through the stack of good housekeeping magazines my grandmother kept in a basket on the floor, I came across a recipe for Lipton Sun Tea. I took the page to my grandmother and asked if we could make it. She already had the tea bags, of course. In fact, we already had tea. My grandmother always had a fresh pitcher in the refrigerator. But neither of us could deny the appeal of something as simple as brewing our favorite beverage in the sun. That day, she took me to Rose's, a discount store in town, and we bought a special sun tea jar, one with a yellow screw-top lid and a spigot to release the tea. Back at home, we filled it up with water, put in 3 family-sized tea bags, and set the jar on the concrete walkway, taking advantage of our newfound use for the sweltering August heat. Then we just waited. We willed the clouds to stay away. We laughed about how our sun tea would turn into cloud tea, and nobody wanted that. We checked on our concoction every 15 minutes, tilting the jar from side to side. We drank glasses of our already made tea from the refrigerator, and, while it was sweet and delicious, we were convinced that it would be inferior to what was sitting outside in the sun, if for no other reason than the sheer time it was taking. Gradually, the sides of the jar heated up, and the water began to tint a deep amber color, like resin or syrup, taking on a rich bronze hue, as if the sun itself had permeated the jar. It took all day. By dinner time, we finally proclaimed it done, and poured ourselves a glass. The tea was warm and melted the ice in our glasses, and it went down sweeter and more delicious than anything I'd ever had. We drank nearly the entire jug in one sitting, going back to the spigot for more, saying how, yes, it was worth the wait, the way so many good things, done simply, are. When I look back now, I can remember the ease of those long summer days, and how the simplest activities enacted beneath the blaze of an August sky, searching for 4 leaves in a patch of clover, smelling approaching rain just before a storm, brewing sunshine in a gallon jar, were the most fulfilling. It's no wonder we stretched them out for as long as possible. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening. I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.